From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll speak with local labor leader Jesus Salas about the roots and legacy of the farm workers movement. Then we'll visit one local farm that's putting waste to good use.
Farming can go through its really tough periods, right? So we tried to create something that had more momentum, so when you do hit a tough spell, down markets, weather challenges, that you can come out the other side.
We'll learn about a community garden that takes beauty seriously.
I firmly believe that every neighborhood in this city deserves beauty. And so to me, as a total gardener geek, to me that was flowers. To me that was having the beauty of the natural surroundings.
Plus recommend places for both humans and dogs to enjoy sweet treats. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're featuring some of the stories recognized for excellence in journalism in 2023 by the Midwest Broadcast Journalists Association, the Milwaukee Press Club, the Radio Television Digital News Association, and the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. WUWM won more than 20 awards, so we unfortunately can't fit them all into one show, but you can find the complete list of award-winning stories at WUWM.com. We'll start with this. Modern agriculture can create a lot of waste, but that doesn't mean it needs to go to waste. At Crave Brothers Farmstead in Waterloo, Wisconsin, they're turning that waste into profit by reusing the manure made by their cows. Liquids, solids, and even gas created by manure are repurposed around the farm in the form of fertilizer, bedding, and methane that's used to create electricity that powers their farm, their cheese factory, and homes in the community. It's all made possible with the anaerobic methane digester, a device that separates the different parts of the manure. Last spring, Lake Effect's Joy Powers ventured out to the farmstead with WUWM's Lena Tran to meet with Mark Crave, one of the brothers and the general manager of Crave Brothers.
What is on these trucks? I keep seeing
these
them.
Trucks right here are hauling manure.
Okay.
And so we are required, we're a CAFO, we're an evil CAFO, right, that we hear about. We cannot apply manure from the time the ground freezes up in the fall until 1st of April, meaning we can't haul on frozen ground. Of course, the cows are living every day, they're producing milk every day, and they're also generating manure every day. We store it, and then when spring comes, we apply it to the fields, as I described earlier, as fertilizer for the crops we're gonna grow. So all of those fields, we take soil samples and determine what nutrients are in the soil. Then we also know through research, through science, how much the subsequent crop is gonna utilize, whether it be corn, wheat, soybeans, alfalfa is what we grow. And we know that a corn crop will use X amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, et cetera, throughout the growing season. So we match what the soil already has in it, what the plant's gonna need, and we make up the difference with our manure and other fertilizer. And so today we're just, it's our first day of hauling this spring. The last time we hauled was around Thanksgiving time.
Yep. All right.
So it's a lot of activity, but we have to have a lot of storage so that we can apply it at the time of the year when we're permitted to. And also we get, by applying it now, we get more effective value out of it versus the manure sitting there all winter and volatilizing, especially nitrogen. Nitrogen will volatilize, go up in the air.
Do you have excess manure? Is that something that comes up?
No, we don't have excess. We because we have a closed loop, we can match how much we apply with the crops that we're taking off. So no, we don't have excess manure. We apply it. You know, the times we have excess really are around, but depending on our crop rotation. So for example, corn will use a lot more nutrients than soybeans will. Soybeans being a legume will generate their own nitrogen. So we match the manure to the crop that we're growing, the amount of manure.
All right.
And so by doing that, we bring in very little outside fertilizer. Right.
So these animals eat the alfalfa. Do they eat corn? Do they eat soybeans?
Yes.
Are these all crops that they're eating?
Yes, yes. So we'll go look at that next. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
This is just a big shed where we store feed. So on a livestock operation, including dairy, feed is our number one expense. In our case, it's probably about 45% of our production cost. So it's a huge part of what we do. And we match feed and nutrition are one and the same, right? And we're matching the nutritional needs with the livestock with what crops we can grow in the glacial drumlin terrain of southern Wisconsin. For us here, our number one crop is corn and corn for silage. And what that means is instead of harvesting the grain, you harvest the entire plant and chop it up. Of course, cows are ruminants. They need a lot of fiber and they can digest fiber that you and I can't. And so they do a great job of taking materials that would otherwise go to waste. If we just harvested the corn, shipped the corn down the Mississippi River, all those corn stalks would stay in the field. But in our case, we harvest all the corn stalks and the grain, goes through the cows, and then what the cow doesn't digest ends up back on the field in the form of manure.
One of the questions I have, especially looking at where all the cows are, how do you collect their manure? To me, there doesn't seem an obvious collection site.
Well, we'll go see that. Yeah, manure management is a big part of what we do in designing our farms and our livestock facilities, certainly. So every year, these silos are filled and emptied. It's a constant cycle, filling and emptying. There's no start or stop to an agricultural or a livestock system. It's kind of the whole chicken and egg thing, if you pardon the pun. But it starts with the crop, but of course, in the end, we have the cow manure that we put it back on the fields for fertilizing the next crop. So there's no point in time to say, here's where our season stops and starts. And it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun that way, too. You're always part of the loop. Now, not every farm does this. So now we're kind of getting into a specialized area where there's maybe 20 or 25 farms in the state. But this is a manure digester system. So there's another tank like this over here. We have two tanks. And you know what? I'm going to pull up here and we can get out. We collect the cow's manure. So you say, how do you collect it? Well, it's built in the system where we collect the cow's manure. We pump it in these tanks. And in there, again, it ferments. And it's about 100 degrees. We add heat to it to where it ferments at that heat and it generates methane. We pipe off the methane. And in our case, we run it through an engine that turns a generator. And so we're actually producing electricity. We also run whey from our cheese factory through here, and whey has a lot of lactose in it, which is highly fermentable. It's sugar.
Was the vision always to be like this, like how you say, like integrated, localized?
A little bit. We'd always liked farming. We always liked the work associated with it, like caring for cattle. But especially my older brothers always had a little bit more of a vision beyond just having a farm and creating something that had a little more momentum to it. And farming can go through its really tough periods, right? So we tried to create something that had more momentum so when you do hit a tough spell, down markets, weather challenges, that you can come out the other side. Certainly didn't envision having our own cheese plant at that time, but that fell into that mindset. We were already dairy farming 20 years when we decided to get in the cheese business. And so, but that fit in the whole thing of creating our own markets. Again, as I said, creating a little more momentum, capturing a little more of the consumer dollar than we were able to just by selling commodity milk. And now with that, we have the digester in place. We've grown staff. So when I first moved here in 88 with my brothers, the four of us provided 95% of the labor on the farm. We had a couple neighbor kids that come over, high school kids, and help us out. And it was a fun. We were young and full of energy, but it got to be drudgery. And over time, we knew that we needed to scale the place up so we could specialize a little bit, so we could have more of a modern lifestyle than what dairy farmers had typically experienced. And so, with that, we grew staff. We developed our cheese business. Now we have 11 family members and 80 full-time non-family staff. Everything from people that feed calves, milk cows, feed the cows, run the digester. Across the road, we have lab personnel. We have several cheesemakers. My brother and my nephew are cheesemakers also. Shipping, receiving, the whole thing. So it's kind of fun because we have mechanics. So of those 80 people, we have the full gamut of skill sets. And so it's really fun to see that and develop that and just try to make it all work.
This is a really big operation, as you say. You even actually described yourself as a CAFO.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that as someone who grew up on a farm? Because there's so much controversy around CAFOs.
There's controversy for people that don't understand what they are. There's no controversy for me, right? It's a badge of honor for me because I know, again, the details behind what it is, what the regulations are. So being a CAFO just means you're regulated. So we operated at a set of rules that farms that aren't CAFOs don't even have to deal with. So actually, most CAFOs operate at a higher level of environmental stewardship and sustainability than maybe what some other farms do. For one reason is because we're regulated. Another thing is we're able to build that in. As we grow our dairy farms, we're able to incorporate a lot of those things into our facilities, right? So when we build a barn, we incorporate the manure handling and the cow cooling and some of the things that benefit the cow, that benefit the environment. We're able to bring in the digester. A farm with 50 cows can't afford a digester, right? They just can't. It just doesn't scale, right? And so the devil is, again, really in the details. And if you really dive into it and look at it closely, CAFOs are actually on the cutting edge of a lot of stewardship initiatives. You got one thing to remember, a lot of CAFOs got to be that way, got to be large farms because they were very good farmers. They were very good farmers when they had 25 cows or 50 cows or 100 cows, and they kept growing it. They were economically successful, they knew what they were doing, and they kept growing it and growing it and growing it. I don't know of a single CAFO that exists because somebody said, you know what, I don't care about anything else, I just want this big business. No, they all came via evolution of a start with a smaller farm.
It seems like for you, to some extent, sustainability, I don't want to say it was an afterthought, but you've really focused on the cow's kind of experience, the dairy part of it, and then it seemed like, oh, well, since we're doing this, since we have so many head of cattle, or since we have so many cows here, we should start to incorporate these aspects of sustainability. Where would you say it lands on your priorities now? Do you think sustainability is a key to your operation?
Yeah, certainly, you know, and that is somewhat an accurate description. When I first started farming, we were all concerned about crops and cows, right? Then it got to be, well, we can't do this ourselves, so we need to hire staff. So now we developed ourselves as teaching, mentoring, training staff, right? So now we're people, right? And I'm going back to like the 1990s, right? Then we got to where we started looking at the technology change, cover crops, low tillage, you know, reduced tillage, no-till systems, things like that came into vogue in the 2000s. And so it just slowly creeps into what you do. First and foremost, you have to remember, as I've shared, a lot of what we do other than the digester, we would do regardless. We've always used manure for fertilizer. We've always harvested our feeds and kept it local. We've just expanded on that whole mindset. People have fed brewer's grain to cows in southern Wisconsin for 100 years. You know, I know a lot of old-timers that said, oh, I used to drive my dad into Milwaukee with a truck and fill it up with brewer's grain and feed it to the cows. So that's always existed. We just don't talk about it a lot. But now, one of the things we've embraced the sustainability mindset on this farm because we're already doing so much of it. A lot of farmers go, oh, what are they talking about? I say, no, think about it. We're already doing a lot of things that people want us to do. We just have to, number one, explain what we're doing, and number two, use the science and the information, use the numbers behind it, so that instead of somebody saying, oh, farmers are just dumping manure on their fields. No, we're not dumping manure on our fields. We're putting manure out at a rate that's a prescription to meet the needs of that growing crop. It's very sustainable, right? CAFOs have no choice. We sign our name on a line that says this is how we're gonna do it. And if I sign my name on it and say that's what I'm gonna do, then I do it. Or I don't sign it.
Mark Crave is the general manager of Crave Brothers Farmstead in Waterloo, Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and WUWM's Lena Tran at the farmstead. This story won awards for audio from both the Midwest Broadcast Journalists Association and the Milwaukee Press Club. Jesus Salas is a noted labor leader who as a young man was inspired by Cesar Chavez and helped to found Obreros Unidos, Workers United. The organization led a historic march from Wautoma to Madison to demand lawmakers address the violations of the state's minimum wage laws and housing codes. In addition to fighting for migrant workers' rights, Salas also joined forces with other Milwaukee civil rights leaders like Father Grappi and Vel Phillips to advance even more community causes. Salas wrote a book that explores the roots and legacy of the farm workers movement and beyond, and it's called Obreros Unidos, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. He joins me now to share more about what he's learned from the decades of organizing, starting with the impact of organizing families.
The first three or four chapters of the book, because of where I was situated in the workforce, we used to work in crews, like in the cotton fields. We were all segregated with the Afro-Americans. And even here in Wisconsin, there would be different crews from different parts of Texas. So on the outside were the males, our fathers, the older males. And then the unmarried women were towards the end of the crew. And then the younger those of us, and we started out very young, as you noted in the book. I was 7 years old when we started migrating. We were towards the center with our aunt, my mother, and my aunt. So the picture that I write is of women working, women and children working. That was my point of view from the very beginning. And the other thing that I think that is mindful of it being a family workforce was we would have never had a youth movement. We would have never had a women's movement grow out of the farm workers movement if it hadn't been family-based. So, you know, I tell my brothers and sisters in the labor movement now, you have to engage the whole family. You can't leave the, you know, mom at home. You know, this is primarily a male-dominated labor union, labor unions. You know, the other thing that I think is important in relationship to the family was the what we call social unionism. In other words, we wanted to provide services. We won elections for a union contract in 67 after organizing 65 and 66. But Libby's wouldn't, the company, the multinational that we organized, wouldn't negotiate with us. They moved all their operations out of state. So then we went into the processing plants, into Libby's canning company. So we went from the fields to the canning operations. And of course, I had been working with Chavez, Cesar Chavez, during this period of time. And he said, look, you've been at it almost 5 years. If you help me with the great boycott, I'll help you with the win in Wisconsin. Once we win in California, I'll come and help you in Wisconsin. Who was to know it was going to take us 5 years to win the first contract in the great boycott? But here I come to Milwaukee in 1968. Of course, you know what was going on in Milwaukee in 68, the open housing marches, et cetera, Father Grappi and the Youth Council. But right. We kept on organizing families the same way that we organize in the field. So the whole nexus of organizing youth, organizing women, I think we had both, not only in the fields in central Wisconsin, but when we came here to Milwaukee also, because we never changed our way of organizing.
Right. And on the note of Father Grappi, and there was a movement between you and the other leaders like Grappi, Chavez, also Vel Phillips, to name one, where you combined forces of the farm workers and the civil rights movements here in Milwaukee.
And that's very, very little noted. I was very happy to address those issues. And I call it the intersection between the civil rights movement and the farm workers movement. And I don't know if it happened by accident, but when I came to Milwaukee, Father John Maurice at the archdiocese-funded offices at 524 West National gave me a back room to work the great boycott out of there. And lo and behold, that same summer of 68, Father Grappi is marching from the north side to Ellen Bradley, just several blocks down the street. So I just walked over and introduced myself, and you know, that was the beginning.
That's how it started.
How it started. And he joined with us at the Great Boycott in Capitol Drive against Kohl's food stores when we started expanding the activities into accessing the University of Wisconsin here in Milwaukee. He joined us there. And of course, we joined together with the welfare marches. So I joined with not only Father Grappi, but I met Vel Phillips and Orville Pitts. Lloyd Barbie was a master of ceremony at one of our steel workers' hall at that time. And then when he started the lawsuit of the to desegregate the Milwaukee public school system, we piggybacked and we demanded the bilingual education and the hiring of bilingual staff, et cetera. So yes,
those things
intersected the farm workers movement and the civil rights movement. It was a great pleasure to work with Father Grappi, to get to know Vel Phillips and work with Lloyd Barbie in the desegregation lawsuit. Yeah,
absolutely. What kind of lessons about strategizing and leadership did you learn from them when you were working with them?
Well, it's interesting that you talk about lessons learned. And you always, you know, if you keep your eyes open, you're always learning. This is the first time I ever lived in a city, that first of all, okay? That, being a migrant worker, we've ever just lived in not only rural areas, but in very small communities. So I was very apprehensive about living in Milwaukee. Of course, I can't. You know, I never survived the experience. I fell in love with it when I came here. But I recall Father Grappi, you know, stopping over and watching us organize at the Kohl's food store on Capitol Drive. And he's telling me, he says, Jesus, you do a great job. You come out, you got all your leaflets printed. When the people come over, you give them the leaflet, don't buy grapes and that, you know, write letters to the growers so they will negotiate with the farm workers in California and that. But, you know, you got to apply a little bit of direct action. He says, well, what is that, Father Grapp? And he says, well, you know, you've been, how many weeks are you going on now? More than a month that you've been here picketing, and they're still, you know, they won't take the grapes off, you know. I says, yeah, you know, we get real angry about that. Well, why don't you go over when the customers are coming in? Why don't you go over there and stop them at the parking lot? Talk to them, you know, tell them to go chop someplace else. And that's what we started to do. We started adapting, and of course, and then we went even further when we, committing civil disobedience as such, you know, peaceful, nonviolent, et cetera.
Good trouble.
You know, good trouble, yes, as a congressman would say. But yes, we learned quite a bit.
We mentioned Cesar Chavez before. He said something along the lines of, there are no natural-born leaders. Would you agree? Do you consider yourself
absolutely.
A leader?
No, Well, there are people that have certain skills. You know, I think people associate oratorical skills with, you know, having the ability to be able to consider, but not necessarily as such a... Right out of college, my sophomore year, and for the next 3 years, I worked organizing children, trying to get their parents to, send them to Las Escuelitas, the little schools. And the schools grew from one demonstration project that's 1962 to seven centers all over central Wisconsin. So here I'm going back to Texas to recruit because there was no bilingual faculty, and we needed at least one bilingual faculty in each of those seven centers. So I had no authority to hire anybody. But the long and short of it is the United Migrant Opportunity Services, which is still going on right now 50 years later, get funded to provide child care, but in southeastern Wisconsin. So not only had I been a farm worker, and all the people, when I was organizing, people knew my background. And then when I went back into the camps to organize the daycare centers, it was to convince the farm workers that this is what we should do to improve our working and living conditions. That was a task. It wasn't that I had no abilities or that, you know, but it was just how do we do this? And of course, I was new to it. The very first strike was a disaster, and I take full responsibility because we got caught. We got caught without a lot of knowledge about how you conduct a strike, you know, get assigned the cards. And, you know, farm workers, like everybody else, they don't like to sign things if they don't know what they're getting into, you know, so things like that. And many of them had never even voted before. So the following year, when we ordered an election, that was the first time many of them had ever voted, because the franchise, of course, doesn't come until, the early, the mid-60s. So, yeah, there was a lot of lessons learned myself. So Cesar is right. Yeah, there's no natural-born leaders. You have to be trained. And to convince the police and the authorities, law enforcement, that we were a peaceful, you know, demonstration. And we, you know, most of the time we did, but it took some time. I had never been to jail in all the years, 4 or 5 years that I was in the labor camps. When I got to Milwaukee, I couldn't stay out of jail, you know. But just every time we went out in the streets, you know, the sergeant would come in, that one, you know, that kind of thing.
So, yeah. So learning how to organize and then in turn learning how to lead.
And learning how to live in a completely different environment, an urban environment where... You know, we never had any difficulties, any challenges, that kind of challenges in the field. We were out by ourselves most of the time, and unless, you know, it wasn't until we got here that we had to adjust those issues, and they had to adjust for us too. So make adjustments for us too. So.
Well, I mean, lots of adjustments, lots of decades of action, lots of reaction and change.
Right.
And,
right.
Your book is not just about what you've helped move forward in the past. It's also about what's left to do and accomplish that's in front of us. So what are some key things you think need to change for Milwaukee's Latinx community to continue to thrive?
Well, for instance, the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee could do a better job providing more extensive hiring of the faculty. I know this is a bad time of the fiscal year to be talking about that because of the present legislature has not been very kind to funding the university, even though, you know, we've at the University of Madison, we've kept tuition frozen for some time, and then the children, qualified applicants of undocumented, have to pay out-of-state tuition. When I was a member of the Board of Regents, we convinced the chancellors to provide some assistance to them, and then I worked with Governor Doyle to pass an in-state tuition for what we call the Dreamers. And then Governor Walker, when he came in 2010, not only takes away our right to organize as public employees, but takes away the right of the Dreamers to pay in-state tuition. So it's a big gap that needs to be remedied. And Voces de la Frontera, I'm still active with them to see if we can remedy that. The driver's license, that was just punitive. There was no reason. If you believe in safe roads, there shouldn't be anybody out there driving without learning how to drive. And the fact that you have a whole community because they simply haven't processed their documentation. Two political parties haven't been able to come together and resolve some of the issues. Look at the border, that is the issues that are going on right now. And look at the idea of inclusion and diversity in our colleges. And the legislature just said $32 million at the University of Wisconsin are not going to be funded for this. Diversity and inclusion is not solely about including African Americans or Latinos, or in other words, minorities. Those are the things I think that are still out there that weren't there when we were organizing, that still need to be addressed. And it takes all of us, takes a whole community to respond to that and to delve into these issues and find out what's going on and to be critical about the issues that are on the table as such.
Jesus Salas is a noted labor leader and the author of Obreros Unidos, The Roots and Legacy of the Farm Workers Movement. He joined me in studio in the fall of 2023, and our conversation received an award of merit for talk in public affairs from the Midwest Broadcast Journalists Association. WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why Wisconsin is so important in this election year. New episodes drop every Wednesday leading up to the Republican National Convention, and you can find it wherever you listen to your podcasts. Coming up later on in the show, we'll learn about a local ice cream shop that only caters to four-legged clients. But first, we'll visit a community garden that takes beauty seriously by inviting student artists to create art and infrastructure to supplement the fresh produce and flowers already growing. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. When you think of the Housing Authority of Milwaukee, you probably think of, well, housing. But one Housing Authority lot serves a different purpose, neighborhood beauty. Located near 23rd and Cherry Street in the Midtown neighborhood on Milwaukee's north side, Cherry Street Community Garden is a place for residents to connect to their agricultural roots and nurture beauty. Recently adorned with community art thanks to a grant, the Cherry Street Garden has been a place for area residents, many living in adjacent Housing Authority property, to gather amongst food and art. Lake Effect Sam Woods visited the garden to learn more about how it was founded and what it's become.
In a city of concrete, nicknamed after cream-colored bricks, keeping a connection to your family's agricultural roots might seem impossible, or at least impractical. But Santana Webb is finding a way. Now, she's only a freshman in high school, but she has been growing food next to her Midtown neighborhood home for over 10 years, together with her grandmother, Linda. Now, I visited her garden plot recently, and let me tell you, she beams with pride when she tells me about everything she's growing, from the tomatoes to the jalapenos, the peppers, the beans, all of it. But she also is reflective about how nurturing these crops helps her connect to her family's southern roots.
My mom and my grandmother was actually raised in the South, so They make fried green tomatoes every now and then, and tomatoes are just great. And then the collards, my mom and my grandmother, when they were in the South, they used to let the frost hit them first, and then they would pick them because they taste better like that, and they're more like tender and stuff. So, and then she stores them in freezer bags so she could use them for like holidays like New Year's Eve, Christmas. Sometimes she cooks them on Easter, so just like special events.
And while Santana is the one connecting to family traditions established in previous generations, she actually played a big role in getting her family gardening again after they moved to Milwaukee. Originally starting in the Cherry Street Garden with her grandmother as a child, she slowly brought more and more of her family across the parking lot from their home to dig into the soil and develop their roots.
Basically, after like the first or second year of gardening, I went back to my mother and I was telling her about it, and like I was so eager. Like my mom, she knew that I really liked it. So I asked her, would she start coming out and get a garden for me, and so we could have our own garden. And she was like, all right. She was like, I'll try it. And so she started coming with me and my grandmother. And basically, once we got her out, we got my other grandmother out. And since then, everyone has been gardening.
Stories like these bring a smile to Lisa Ruskowski's face. In 2012, Lisa and her husband Rick founded Cherry Street Garden, built on land owned by the Housing Authority and operated by Bloom MKE, a nonprofit that manages the garden, in addition to providing gardening education programs and even little free library book drives. The garden was named for its proximity to Cherry Street in Milwaukee's Midtown neighborhood. But the cherry trees that line the garden's borders today would coincidentally come later.
Yeah, this garden's really blossomed over the last 10, 12 years. So we started with 19 raised beds. We've now grown to 33, plus a few little spot gardens to kind of highlight some additional growing techniques. And then in 2015, the city put in an orchard space here. So we have cherry trees growing at Cherry Street Garden.
Makes sense.
And then I think we're actually the only orchard that got the cherry trees that year. So we're very happy to have those.
They probably saw your application in the grant. Like, well, we have to give it to them, right?
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular also. The cherry trees are incredibly productive. Anybody and everybody should come by and pick those in July because we have plenty to share.
All right.
And then we have the apple trees, which are just coming into bloom now, or into harvest time now, making some amazing apple cider out here in the garden, a few different events. So we've grown both in the number of beds we have as well as having the orchard. And we've also refurbished a lot of our beds from being the original 8-inch high beds to being more accessible 24-inch beds, because more than half the gardeners here are older or elderly and or physically disabled. So our goal is for people to be able to easily reach into their bed, to be fully participating in the garden experience.
Yeah, and so on that note of the gardeners who are here, the people who are gardening here, I see names on a lot of these beds, right? And from talking to some of the gardeners, my understanding is that a lot of them live in the surrounding area, right?
Correct. So almost everybody who gardens here lives within walking distance. So either they live a block over at the Cherry Court Apartments, which is the Housing Authority building, or there's our surrounding neighborhoods, neighbors, which is great. Keeps a lot of eyes on the garden, keeps people walking over and engaged. This is classified as a food desert, so it's really nice to have a space here where healthy food's getting grown. We have a couple beds that we plant just to share with neighbors, so that even if you don't buy in and have a bed and are one of the garden club members, you're still welcome here.
Lisa and Rick established this garden for a very tangible purpose: access to healthy food in a food desert. Over time, though, the garden has served additional intangible purposes, like connecting Santana and her family to their southern roots, and recently becoming a place where beauty is celebrated. At first, this meant flowers on the grounds. Natural for a garden, right? But last year, Bloom MKE received a grant to get some public art in the garden. They went straight to gardeners for ideas, who came back to them with ideas on how to celebrate the community that was building there, as well as to serve a functional purpose, like benches that are easy for people with mobility issues to get into and out of, as well as a shade station held up by totems designed by local students, as well as murals to celebrate the gardeners there. Altogether, these pieces are helping the garden function as a gathering place, both for pollinators and for people.
I firmly believe that every neighborhood in this city deserves beauty. And so to me, as a total gardener geek, to me that was flowers. To me that was having the beauty of the natural surroundings. But then when we had this opportunity to get this community challenge grant from the Joy Engine Project, they gave us, you know, the money and the founding and honestly the inspiration to say, hey, what else could you do here? And it has been out of this world transformational to me. As beautiful as it is, it's just a whole nother level now that there's art in the space. So they gave us this grant in the summer of 2022. And in the fall, we started meeting with gardeners and doing listening sessions and saying, what would you want to see? And some themes came out really strongly. One was the gardeners felt that this is a space that's important for community building and community gathering. So they wanted to see more seating. They wanted to see some shade. I mean, you know, none of us love sitting on the hot sun, but especially if, you know, if you're elderly or if you're on some, you know, blood pressure medications, that hot sun can be dangerous. So we had the idea of part of the art could be this shade oasis that we're sitting in right now. And so, you know, we have the shade sail above us, but then instead of just having posts in the ground, we have these totems that were designed by Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design students and then carved by University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee architecture students. So we have these carved totem posts holding up the shade sail. And then we have these amazing benches that were designed by the architecture students and built by them. And they are creative and comfortable,
yeah,
I'm glad to say.
Yeah, sure.
So it's been really amazing to have this little oasis right in the middle of the garden. So you can sit here and look out at your plants and enjoy the natural beauty and be very comfortable doing that. But then if you look around at the five different mural projects that are in here, it just blows my mind. Each one was done by a different Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design or a MIED student or a group of students. But what you see is that they really heard from the listening sessions that we shared with them how important it was that the garden talk about family, that it talk about legacy and the legacy of agriculture for people moving up from the South, and as well as the sense of community they wanted to feel in this space. So when you look at these pieces, they're all unique and different. The artists have totally different styles, but you absolutely feel that sense of groundedness and community and family and how important the agricultural roots that this community has, even though they're now living in urban settings. And so to me, each piece really powerfully speaks for itself.
One of those MIAD design students that Lisa mentioned is Isaac Pulliam. He met Lisa and Rick through the school's service learning program, and he was immediately drawn to the project. He listened to stories about Santana and her grandmother and knew he wanted to feature them in a mural that he would create for the garden.
Well, when we heard about this opportunity, it was in the middle of winter, so there wasn't much action here in the garden. So
we don't really go outside in the winter.
Yeah. So basically, I just got a whole lot of photos from Lisa of Santana and her family, and I just created a Photoshop composition of the different photos that I had from them.
Now, Isaac is a humble guy, and he's not one to talk himself up, and believe me, I tried to get him to do so. Because this is a beautiful piece. Beautiful in just a matter-of-fact, everyday slice-of-life kind of sense. It captures Santana and her grandmother carrying their harvest home amidst a backdrop of cherry trees and fruiting tomatoes. When you look at the mural, it's as if Santana just noticed you standing there, while her grandmother just looks ready to get home and fry some fresh tomatoes after a long day harvesting. And Isaac is happy with how the piece turned out, but he's also happy with where it ended up. He sees gardens as a natural place for the visual arts to live, because he sees gardeners as artists who have a similar process to muralists like himself, but just happen to use soil as their medium instead of paint.
It's a good feeling to be part of this community, and especially being in a community of gardeners, there's a lot of connections that go hand in hand with gardening and art, especially like from beginning to end. Deciding out, you got to planning out like the process. You got to plan out everything, like how you're gonna apply everything, what materials you have to use that gets put into everything, and you don't really know how it's gonna turn out until it's a finished product.
After spending about an hour in the garden with Santana, Lisa, and Isaac, it felt like an extended exhale, more than a breath of fresh air. Cherry Street is a reminder of how beautiful our city can be when we take the time to nurture and appreciate it. For Lake Effect, I'm Sam Woods.
The Cherry Street Community Garden is located near 23rd and Cherry Street and is managed by Bloom MKE, a nonprofit organization that uses gardening to foster community engagement. That story was done by Lake Effect Sam Woods, and it won second place for best news and talk writing from the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in July. You can help shape our coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find a link at WUWM.com, and what you share with us will help inform the stories that you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. Bubble tea shops have been popping up all over the Milwaukee area. We'll explore the Taiwanese origins of the trendy drinks next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Bubble tea shops have been popping up all over the Milwaukee area. It's a drink that can come in all flavors and all levels of sweetness, with tea or no tea, milk, no milk, and often with signature tapioca pearls and jellies at the bottom. WUWM's Mayan Silver looks at the Taiwanese origins of the drink.
In a small kiosk in Mayfair Mall's second-story food court, Xiaoxiang Hu is brewing fresh jasmine tea. Pitchers of black, Thai, and oolong teas are lined up in a rainbow of colors.
Our teas are all overseas. So our Assam tea, black tea, are from India. Our jasmine tea are from China. And oolong from Taiwan.
What makes a bubble tea shop different than a regular tea shop is the reliance on boba, tapioca pearls made of cassava flour. Generally served cold, it can also have other sweet jellies or popping balls that go in the bottom of your drink and are sucked up by a big, thick straw. At Bubblicious in Mayfair, Hu stirs a pot of bubbling boba as steam coils out of the top. She rinses the boba and starts to make a popular Taiwanese bubble tea drink.
A tiger black milk tea.
When you put together a bubble tea, most toppings go in first.
Here we go, the boba in the cup.
Hu squeezes brown sugar syrup down the sides of the cup.
So they kind of like a tiger stripe on there. And then
she pours in some crisp black tea, scoops some ice from the freezer, gently drops the ice into the tea, tops the tea off with some creamy Wisconsin milk.
And here is the tiger black milk tea.
Hu seals the drink with a pour-proof layer of plastic. As she shakes up the drink, the sweet white cream leisurely marbleizes through the black tea. The drink is now ready for a customer to puncture the top and sip away.
Here we go.
The tapioca starch for boba comes from the South American cassava plant. According to Eater magazine, cassava arrived in Taiwan via Southeast Asia in the 19th century, and people there already had a taste for jelly-like starch desserts. Bubble tea originated in Taiwan in the 1980s. It's a story of competing tea shops, and Hu really came up with putting tapioca pearls in tea is disputed territory. Here's Li Chi Chai, president of UWM's Taiwanese Student Association, who met us at Elite Boba on Farwell. He's from one of the cities that claims to have started boba tea culture in Taiwan.
So I'm originally from Taichung, Taiwan, which is the center of Taiwan. I should say like the boba tea restaurant is called Chun Shui Tang, and then that's originally from Taichung. There's a debate between Chun Shui Tang in Taichung and then also another Hanlin tea shop in Tainan. They're debating like who is the original.
The shops went to court in a prolonged lawsuit over bubble tea, but no one ended up with any trademarks or patents.
There's no answer for who is the original, and maybe people in Taiwan, they don't care much. They just like boba. Whoever's from, as long as it tastes good.
And if you're wondering about the names bubble tea and boba, well, bubble comes not from the additions to the tea itself, but because the tea is originally hand-shaken, which leaves little bubbles at the top of the tea. Boba now refers to the tapioca pearls in particular. But the story goes, a famous and busty Taiwanese film star ordered pearl milk tea. The pearls got nicknamed boba, which was also slang for large breasts. These days, you can get fruity teas with jellies that are rectangular, not round, and taste sweeter like a firm jello. At places like Elite Boba, you can also get pudding or cheese top, which is a layer of more firm, savory, yogurt-like cream that you can mix into your tea.
If you like savory flavor, you definitely want to try cheese on top.
Back at Bubblicious in Mayfair Mall, Xiaoxuan Hu saw Nina Chesser tentatively approach the kiosk.
What's that?
All right.
The bubbles?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. You do want it. Yeah.
Have you had it before?
No. Never had it.
Chesser's daughter had been urging her to try it. So she ordered, and Hu walked her through her first sip of a boba milkshake.
You'll poke through.
And the verdict?
Delicious.
Ayan Silver, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
That was WUWM's Mayan Silver story on bubble tea, which won third place for best use of audio in radio news from the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. We just heard about the rise of bubble tea in the Milwaukee area, but our four-legged friends can't enjoy that. WUWM's Taryn Powell got to visit a doggy ice cream shop in the Third Ward called Salty Paws.
Picture a hot summer day in Milwaukee and you're having a day out with your canine best friend. You decide you want to grab some ice cream with them to cool off. Well, there's a new spot in the Third Ward where that picture comes to life. Okay, this place doesn't sell human ice cream, but it does sell ice cream for your dog, and you can enjoy seeing them enjoy a cold treat. At 121 North Jefferson Street, that spot is Salty Paws, a doggy ice cream store, bakery, and retail shop. I took my dog, Leah, to Salty Paws for an ice cream taste test and to meet the owner. The owner, Linda Smith, came from behind the ice cream counter to greet us. Inside Salty Paws, the walls and floors are painted this mint green, and there are racks of colorful goodies. I spotted doggy beer, chew toys, and bags of dog treats, to name a few. There are portraits of dogs on the wall. One of them is a French bulldog named Coconut, who's pictured in a birthday hat enjoying some birthday cake. That's Smith's pup, who helps inspire her work. But let's talk doggy ice cream. It's a bit different from human ice cream. Here's Smith.
We make our ice cream in-house, and it comes to us in a powder form. It's lactose-free milk, gelatin, and natural flavor.
Smith says they currently have 12 flavors. Some are like what you'd see in an ice cream parlor for people. Birthday cake, pumpkin, peanut butter. But others are more suited for dog taste buds, like bacon ice cream. Then there's the treats.
We have a variety of goodies in the bakery. Anything from cookies to whoopie pies to pup cakes. And then we have a huge bones bar, which has everything from filled bones to bully sticks and antlers. Just all kinds of chews for dogs to occupy their time.
While I interviewed Smith, Leah occupied her time with a bowl of the current most popular ice cream flavor, bacon cheeseburger. I think she liked it. Salty Paws is a franchise. Smith has several other locations along the Upper East Coast and on the West Coast. But Milwaukee is the first location in the Midwest, and Smith says the store has been getting local and regional love.
People around Milwaukee, people have been coming from every suburb to check us out. People have been traveling from Chicago on the weekends. We get tons of Chicago traffic, which we love.
So why a doggy ice cream shop? Smith says this is the kind of place she would like to hang out with her dog. She says there's not enough spaces, especially indoor, you can go to do something fun with your dog. And she enjoys seeing the joy the experience brings to dogs and their owners.
For me, it never gets old watching the dogs eat ice cream. It's just so precious, and like they just love it so much. But then watching how happy that it makes their humans, watching them eat it is, it just makes me feel good. It makes me happy.
Plus, Smith says it's like a party all day at Salty Paws. You never know what pup will show up. Luckily, I was there for one of those parties. I met regulars Logan and Jean. first timer, Ivy.
She's afraid of little dogs. I don't know why, but
the little one's nice, spicy.
She's a cool girl.
You want to say something?
And another first timer, Noodle, who was celebrating his first birthday. He even got to take some pictures with the birthday banner and enjoyed a couple scoops of vanilla and pumpkin ice cream with peanut butter treats. Smith says for folks who have yet to make a trip to Salty Paws, whether or not you have a dog, if you want to experience pure joy, come watch some dogs eat ice cream. She laughed, saying it's like nothing you've ever seen before. Taryn Powell, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
That was WUWM's Taryn Powell reporting from Salty Paws in Milwaukee. This story won third place for best use of audio and radio news from the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. As I mentioned, these are just a small taste of all the great award-winning stories produced by WUWM's news and Lake Effect teams in 2023. You'll find the complete list of the 23 stories that won both local and regional awards at WUWM.com. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn what's in this summer's Milwaukee Rec Program catalog, including where the kids can go for free splash pads and field trips for our 50 and over population. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.